Is marijuana safer?
Alcohol has been closely linked with violent crime and fighting and domestic violence and sexual assault and injuries, whereas marijuana has never been found to contribute to these very serious problems. In fact, it's often found to inhibit that type of behavior.
That's marijuana policy activist Mason Tvert. We talked to him about the book he co-wrote, Marijuana is Safer.
During 1919, there were race riots across the United States. Historians call it the Red Summer. And not coincidentally, the Red Scare came on the heels of that. So when the Palmer Raids began and people started being deported and prosecuted for being a social democrat, socialists, or Bolsheviks, this was all happening at roughly the same time, which makes it a fascinating period to write about.
And that's Peter Vickery. He tells us about his historical thriller, Madison Hopper and the African-American Blood Brotherhood. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. About 50% of Americans report using marijuana at least once, and the true figure is probably higher, so to speak. When President Obama asked Americans to go on his Open Government Initiative webpage to tell him what problems they thought he should address, legalizing marijuana was at the top of the list. Mason Tvert is a warrior in the trenches of the marijuana legalization movement. In his new book, he says the war on pot is driving people to a much more dangerous drug, alcohol. Tvert says marijuana is not only safer than alcohol, it has real medical benefits, including pain relief, easing glaucoma, increasing appetite for those who are sick, and protecting against Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases. He asks the question, why do we punish adults who make the safer choice to use marijuana instead of alcohol? Tvert is co-founder and executive director of Safer Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation, or SAFER, and the Safer Voter Education Fund. His book, co-written with Steve Fox and Paul Armentano, is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Mason Tvert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Now, when the Obama administration first unveiled its Open Government Initiative, it got flooded with comments in favor of legalizing marijuana. Do you know about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was this a result of a coordinated campaign, or do you think it was a spontaneous upwelling of public opinion?
Well, I certainly think that organizations that work in this field were encouraging folks to contact their elected officials or to sign up for this type of question, but so was every other issue. So I think that this was a very spontaneous grassroots effort. And we saw millions of Americans saying, listen, it's time to change the way we handle this.
So how many Americans do you think do smoke pot or have smoked pot sometime in their life?
Well, based on the survey data we've seen, it's approximately 50% of Americans who have used marijuana. That's a conservative estimate, obviously. It's probably underreported. But given its illegal nature, it's just a remarkable number of people who have still decided to partake.
Now, the foreword to your book, Marijuana is Safer, the foreword to your book is written by the former chief of police of Seattle, Norm Stamper. Why would a chief of police be in favor of the legalization of marijuana?
Well, he's been in the front lines of the war on drugs, and he knows better than anyone that marijuana is really not a problem. It does not contribute to the serious problems that we see, like domestic violence or fighting or sexual assault or other violent crimes. It does not contribute to serious health or social problems. And yet alcohol, a substance that we certainly welcome with open arms in the society, does contribute to those problems. So as he points out in the foreword, every police officer in the country knows that alcohol is far more dangerous than marijuana and contributes to far more problems, and he thinks it's time we recognize that fact.
You give a couple of examples in your book of what you're talking about in terms of marijuana versus alcohol. You start the book talking about a soccer match in Lisbon, Portugal. Tell us what happened there.
Well, this was a case where it was a soccer match that people expected could result in a lot of violence and fighting, hooliganism, and so on. And police in that city said they made it very clear to everyone who was attending the match that if you use marijuana, we're going to look the other way because we would rather you use marijuana instead of drinking. Alcohol is going to be the focus of our efforts. And, of course, as a result, many people did decide to use marijuana, and the game went off without a hitch. There were no serious problems, and it wasn't really until later that night when people were able to go to the bars and get drunk that we started to see a whole lot of problems in that city. But they really demonstrated that when people are given a choice and some use marijuana, far less drinking is going to take place.
We should tell those of our listeners who may not know this, but in Europe, soccer matches are known to be extremely dangerous places, places where the fans go wild.
Absolutely, and it's typically the result of all the alcohol use. There's quite a culture of drinking associated with soccer matches in Europe.
You also bring up the case of U.S. Olympic swimming champion Michael Phelps. Tell us about what happened to him.
Well, Michael Phelps is without a doubt one of the best athletes in the world today, and he was recently in the news this past year when he was at a party in South Carolina where a photo of him was taken smoking some marijuana out of a bong, and it sparked this huge uproar in the media, and he was suspended from his team, he was forced to apologize, he almost lost a particular sponsorship deal with Kellogg's, but it was really a huge to-do over the fact that this young man, who's within the age that most Americans try using marijuana, simply did. And although there were reports that he had been drinking heavily and acting obnoxiously, no one seemed to mind that. But the second he decided to use some marijuana, all of a sudden it was a big deal. And he was shamed into apologizing and so on and punished. And it sent this message that, you know, if you drink or use alcohol, you're going to be okay. But if you use marijuana, you're going to be ridiculed and punished. And it sends a very dangerous message to not just other athletes, but to young people and all people. So we, you know, in light of the fact that the USA swimming team is sponsored by Anheuser-Busch, it's really quite hypocritical, and it's dangerous.
So here you are, you're drawing the contrast between drinking and smoking pot. Your book is Marijuana is Safer, and the subtitle is, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? What do you mean by driving people to drink?
Well, although we do contrast marijuana use and drinking because marijuana is safer, we also do highlight the fact that millions of people use marijuana for the same reasons that they drink. People use marijuana to celebrate. They use it to enhance experiences or as a social lubricant. And really what it comes down to is, you know, these are two interchangeable substances that people use to have a good time. And when we prohibit marijuana yet fully accept alcohol and even threaten people with punishment for using marijuana but promote alcohol use, we're sending this message that says that it's, you know, okay to drink, and in doing so, we're driving people towards drinking. We're threatening them with punishment if they make the choice to use marijuana. We're threatening them with drug tests that only come up, really, with marijuana. They don't actually test for many other things because marijuana stays in your system far longer. So we are seeing an inflated number of alcohol users, an artificially inflated number of alcohol users, and an artificially deflated number of marijuana users as a result of our laws.
Hmm. Lay out the case for us first here. Give us a compare and contrast. Why do you say that marijuana is safer than alcohol? We know that alcohol is bad for you, but why do you say marijuana is safer?
Well, you've just made a very important point right there, is that we do, as a society, know alcohol is harmful, but we do also accept the fact that people like to use it and that it should be legal and that it's okay if people want to get a little intoxicated. So understanding that is really important, that our society does accept the use of a substance like alcohol. That said, marijuana is by every objective standard far safer, and every objective study has concluded that it's less toxic, it's less addictive, it's less harmful to the body, whereas alcohol contributes to 35,000 American deaths every year, and that's not including DUI. We're talking solely about use, so cancer and overdose deaths and cirrhosis of the liver. There's not a single death attributed to marijuana use in this country or any country, and there's never been a marijuana overdose death in history. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, alcohol is far more addictive than marijuana. And, of course, when it comes to the social consequences, alcohol has been closely linked with violent crime and fighting and domestic violence and sexual assault and injuries, whereas marijuana has never been found to contribute to these very serious problems. In fact, it's often found to inhibit that type of behavior. So we really have to ask ourselves, why on earth would our government prefer we use a more dangerous substance than we might otherwise prefer to use?
It inhibits that kind of behavior? What do you mean? Why?
The effect that marijuana tends to have on people is that it makes them calmer, less likely to take risks, they're risk-averse, they're less likely to become aggressive or violent. So ultimately what we see is people who are less likely to engage in risk-taking or violent activity than they might otherwise be. So it, you know, actually inhibits that form of behavior that alcohol tends to make more likely. We see alcohol making people, you know, we call it liquid courage. It makes people take chances, take risks, think they're invincible. And it also makes, you know, for anyone who's been in a crowded bar or a college party, they know that it makes people aggressive and they tend to get a little rowdy and out of control.
Yeah, you say marijuana is less harmful, less addictive. That's still opening the question as to marijuana being harmful and addictive. I mean, for example, if you're driving and you're high, you could, I would say that your functioning is pretty impaired.
That's why I prefaced this by saying, listen, we as a society allow the use of alcohol. We accept that people enjoy using it and that there are some harms. Now, with marijuana, it's far less harmful and far less of a problem, but yet for some reason we don't accept it. And maybe if we did allow people to use marijuana, we'd see fewer people drinking and causing the problems associated with that. We make it very clear in the book that marijuana may not be for everyone. We never call it harmless. We certainly highlight the fact that it could contribute to problems with minors and young people and with driving. But the fact is that driving under the influence of marijuana is currently illegal. It would remain illegal if marijuana remained legal. And it would remain illegal for young people. In fact, changing our laws might actually make marijuana less available for younger people. Very likely.
How would that be?
Well, right now, young people have better access to marijuana than older people. And it's considered by our government to be, quote, universally available to them. And this is very much the result of prohibition. By keeping marijuana in a black market, young people are able to access that market. And there's no one asking for ID or anything. And what we end up seeing is young people able to get marijuana easier than they're able to access alcohol, which is currently the case, according to the government. So why on earth, if marijuana is a problem, wouldn't we want to control it better? But the fact remains that it's not really much of a problem. There really are not a lot of negative consequences, if any, associated with adults using marijuana responsibly.
So you're saying if it were legalized the way alcohol is, that it would the selling, the distribution of marijuana would be more controlled, and just like every time I go to the grocery store, and I, who am many decades away from the age of 21, I have to show my ID every time I buy a bottle of wine. You're saying it would actually make it more difficult for young people to obtain marijuana. And yet marijuana, underage minors have an awful easy time obtaining alcohol if they want to, and that's controlled.
Well, they have a harder time of obtaining alcohol than they do marijuana. And, you know, it's really a sign of a failed policy when our goal with marijuana prohibition is to protect young people from marijuana. But the overall effect is that young people have the best access to it, and old people are not able to access it. And if they want it, they need to go to young people to get it. You know, another issue here is that we're able to control the product. We're able to control what other products are available in that market. For example, if someone is going into a liquor store, they're only going to find liquor. But if someone is purchasing marijuana from, you know, some black market source, whatever it might be, it's possible there's going to be other illegal products available. And they're going to then have that access to the black market and other dangerous drugs. So why not take marijuana, which more people want to use than any other illegal drug in the world, and regulate it? Put it in a store where they aren't going to find other illegal products. Make sure the quality is good. Make sure that only people who are supposed to be getting it are getting it. And have strict penalties against those people who break the rules, much like with alcohol.
We're speaking with Mason Tivert. His book is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? You have a co-author, too, don't you?
There's a couple. Steve Fox, who is the director of state initiatives at the Marijuana Policy Project, and Paul Armentano, who is a deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
We've been hearing a lot about the supposed increased potency of marijuana, that, in other words, this isn't your parents' marijuana. This isn't the same stuff that was around in the 1960s and 70s. Could you address that?
Sure. Well, number one, it's really important to know that regardless of how potent marijuana is, it's absolutely non-toxic, non-lethal, and cannot contribute to an overdose death or other serious injuries simply by using it. That said, this notion that today's marijuana is more potent than yesterday's or that from 25 years ago is generally a myth. What we see is 95% of marijuana samples that are confiscated by police tend to be right about the same as they were 25 years ago. The most potent marijuana today is found to be more potent than it was the most potent marijuana a while back. But again, it's important to point out that, number one, this doesn't have any negative effect on the user. In fact, it somewhat has a positive effect because it means the user is going to use less of it. And it also, what we do find is that many times most marijuana users prefer less potent marijuana. Just like with alcohol, there's, you know, everything from beer to wine to liquor to grain alcohol. A lot of people just prefer drinking beer or wine. With marijuana, it's no different. Even though that hard liquor is out there, a lot of people would rather just use the less potent stuff. But even if they do use the harder, more potent marijuana, there's not any serious consequence associated with it like there is with hard alcohol.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about medical marijuana these days. California has been joined by Michigan in legalizing marijuana for medical use. I found some of the most interesting parts of your book has to do with what you say are the actual health benefits of marijuana. I mean, you make it sound like a panacea. You know, it prevents Alzheimer's and depression and neurological diseases. There's a lot you say there. Give us some of the highlights.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are now 13 or 14 states in the country that have laws that allow people to use marijuana with a doctor's recommendation. And what we find is that marijuana is able to stimulate appetite, as many people know, which is incredibly useful for people suffering from AIDS and HIV or people who are undergoing chemotherapy. It treats nausea. It's found to address, it releases interocular pressure for people who have glaucoma and actually prevents people with glaucoma from going blind. We also see that marijuana has a neuroprotective effect, meaning it generally protects parts of your brain, and there are now actually studies that have concluded. These are studies from formal medical journals that have concluded that if you use marijuana prior to heavy drinking, it will actually prevent the brain damage associated with heavy drinking, because we do have substantial evidence that drinking heavily kills white brain matter. It does kill brain cells, whereas there is no actual evidence of marijuana killing brain cells, contrary to the myths we've always heard. And in fact, using marijuana will protect parts of your brain. We also see marijuana being used as a pain reliever, as an expectorant, and it certainly has a number of benefits. It's been used by people around the world for thousands of years for therapeutic reasons, and there's really no reason why we shouldn't be letting people use it to treat their ailments today.
Do you think that people might want to take some of your statements with a bit of caution, just in the sense that people, there are genetic differences. People may have different reactions.
Absolutely. We actually have a section of the book that's titled, Is Marijuana for Everyone? And the answer is absolutely not. For young people, for teenagers, kids, people with developing brains, there's still a lot we don't know about marijuana, and we certainly don't think people should be using it. And then, of course, when it comes to people who might have, mental health issues or other serious problems where marijuana might become a problem for them, of course it makes sense for them to take caution. But the point here is that, there's no reason for us to be making criminals out of the many millions of people who do enjoy using marijuana and do find that it's a safer alternative to alcohol. We should be providing evidence-based drug education, getting people this information about the harms of these two substances, and letting them make the choice that is really going to benefit them in the long run. Obviously, alcohol is an incredibly addictive substance. Marijuana can be considered addictive. It's not found to have any physical withdrawal symptoms or any other serious addiction indicators. However, if you do anything far too much, you can experience problems with your life. Obviously, if you're doing nothing but using marijuana all day, you're probably not going to have a very good relationship with a spouse or other loved ones. You're probably not going to excel in your job or in school. So doing anything far too much is going to be problematic, and people should recognize that. Eating too much, having sex too much, there's all sorts of things people do have a negative implication on their life, but that doesn't mean we need to make them illegal. It means we just need to provide people with the information that they need to make good decisions when it comes to these types of things.
So you're saying just kind of the way sex can be addictive, well, we're not going to make sex illegal. You wouldn't want to make marijuana illegal.
That's absolutely right. And I would say even more so the way that we find that people, millions and millions of people become alcoholics, that doesn't mean we need to have an outright prohibition of alcohol. We need to tell people about the harms of the substance and also how to take caution and then have ways of treating people with these substance abuse issues, but we should not be criminalizing people who might have a substance abuse problem, and we certainly shouldn't be criminalizing people who don't have problems with these substances but simply enjoy using them.
We're talking with Mason Tvert. The book he co-authored is Marijuana is Safer. So with all of this, I mean, in your book, Marijuana is Safer, you also point out non-medical, non-ingesting uses of marijuana, that is the use of hemp for biofuel, for clothing, for a whole range of things that could help, for example, create safe biofuels rather than corn ethanol, which seems to have more problems than it's worth. So why is marijuana illegal? What's behind the prohibition? You say you should follow the money. What do you mean?
Well, there's long been speculation that when it comes to marijuana's industrial uses, it tends to be a competitor for a lot of other products. But also, alcohol, now that it's legal, has developed a massive lobbying apparatus that gives millions and millions of dollars to local, state, and federal campaigns, and really has carved this niche into our society by sponsoring so many major sporting events, major sports teams, again, giving donations to elected officials, and really making alcohol part of our society. And we are not going to see nearly the backlash to the harms associated with alcohol that we do with marijuana as a result. When it comes to marijuana, however, people have been scared with a misinformation campaign of propaganda that's been going on for 70-plus years. They've been made to fear marijuana for one reason or another, whether they were told it's a gateway drug or whether they were told it will make people, you know, go crazy, or whether they were told it will make, you know, black men rape white women. I mean, all these ridiculous things for so long have created this perception of harm in people that it just has resulted in them not thinking it's worth making it legal. And that's what we're trying to address.
So you're saying it's because the alcohol industry is so big and they've been able to kind of muscle legislation to keep the heat up on marijuana?
It's not so much that they are keeping the heat up on marijuana. It's just that they've managed to make alcohol such a major part of our society. The fact that we have beer ads every other commercial on TV, and we have billboards all over, despite evidence that these types of marketing campaigns do make young people want to drink more, they've gotten away with that. We find that they, you know, can give millions of dollars to candidates, so there are political candidates who are accepting money that is from a liquor company who, you know, who knows how much destruction was caused by the product that was sold. But then those political candidates turn around and say, oh, well, God forbid we allow people to use marijuana because it's illegal and so bad, when in fact it is safer than alcohol. So as a result of all that, they've really managed to monopolize the intoxicant industry here in the United States and abroad.
But it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, you know, the alcohol industry could do very well, thank you, I'm sure, if marijuana were legalized. So why do you think there has been such a tenacious criminalization of marijuana?
Well, like I said, there's been a campaign that's been waged since the 1930s, if not even before that in some places.
But why? Why that campaign?
For a variety of reasons, whether it's moral reasons. I mean, one of the first anti-marijuana crusaders, the first government officials who pioneered the movement against marijuana was a moralist, an evangelical. He thought it was wrong for people to use marijuana. We saw William Randolph Hearst, the publisher who used his newspapers to spread misinformation about marijuana. He was in the publishing industry, and he owned timberland in Mexico. And when that land was taken over by Mexican revolutionaries, he was upset. And so he used his newspapers to spread these, you know, sensationalistic yellow journalist stories about the crazed Mexican who's hopped up on marijuana and killing white people. We saw all these, you know, we saw all those types of things. Now we've seen people who are, you know, these days who are just against marijuana because it's illegal. They don't even know what's wrong with it, but because it's illegal, they think it should remain illegal.
In fact, am I wrong, or do I remember that in your book you make a suggestion that it is even partly the very qualities of marijuana that are kind of peace-inducing, you know, that it's pretty hard to, if you're high on marijuana, to get into any kind of real fight, that there's something about the nature of marijuana itself that contributes to its criminalization in the society.
That's a very good point, and that's really part of what resulted in the anti-marijuana movement in this country really exploding in the late 60s with Richard Nixon. Obviously, the Vietnam War was going on. Nixon was president, and he really noticed, and his administration noticed, that everyone who was against the war, the young people, the radicals, the so-called hippies and so on, the liberals, and then certain groups that he disliked. It's very well known he disliked Jews and blacks and other minorities. All of those people had one thing in common, and it was marijuana. They either used it or associated with people who used it, and he quickly recognized that one way to control those who opposed his agenda or those who he disagreed with was through marijuana laws. And that's when we really saw a huge pickup in the amount of enforcement taking place with regards to marijuana in this country. So there's no doubt that the fact that marijuana appealed to a certain type of person resulted in people fighting it harder.
We're talking with Mason Tvert about legalizing marijuana. We'll talk more after the break.
Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would. They'll stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Mason Tvert about the book he co-authored, Marijuana is Safer. Tvert makes a case for the economic benefits of legalization, especially for cash-strapped state budgets. I asked him why some states, like Michigan and California, might be turning to marijuana as a source of revenue.
Marijuana is projected to be a $113 billion industry, and that's a conservative estimate. By making marijuana legal, not only will we see revenue generated by excise taxes and so on, and of course we'll see savings with regards to the criminal justice system and so on, but we'll also be creating so many jobs. I mean, think about the alcohol industry. It's not just the people who make it and the people who happen to sell it. It's the hostesses and the bartender and the waitress and the owner of the bar and the person who does their marketing and the truck driver that brings the product to the bar. And, it, you know, think about all the venues at which alcohol is sold and every person who works as a beer vendor at a ball game or at a concert. I mean, there's just millions of jobs out there that people could have, but we don't let them have. So all those people, if they were able to have jobs, would be paying income taxes and paying state and local taxes. So we would just see a huge boon to our economy by simply making this a regulated product, much like with alcohol. And of course, then there's also the industrial uses of marijuana, which you mentioned earlier, with regards to industrial hemp products and so on. Right now, hemp is quite a popular thing. It's a very useful product, but it's not being grown in this country because it's illegal, yet it is legal to import it from other countries. So all these other countries are making money producing hemp products and selling them in the United States when this could be a crop that people in Middle America and Kansas and particularly in the Eastern Plains and Colorado could be harvesting and benefiting from.
And we should mention to those of our listeners who may not know, hemp is a variety of marijuana that doesn't have any of the psychoactive substances, or very too few of them to really have any effect.
Correct.
What got you so interested in this campaign yourself?
Well, I have an interesting personal story, which I don't know if it directly sparked my interest, but when I was a high school student, my senior year of high school, I went out to a music festival and drank to the point where I was hospitalized. I was taken by ambulance to a hospital, all because I drank too much. And in the end, I was given a hospital bill. No one cared where I got the alcohol. There was no investigation. Police weren't even involved. Then when I went to college the next year, I was the subject of a school-wide investigation into marijuana use that was coordinated by a multi-jurisdictional drug task force. So this means that everyone from the campus police to the local and state police to the DEA was interested in whether I, as a college student, smoked pot. And, you know, they were wanting to know where it came from and how much it cost and all these things. And really, it struck me as insane that, you know, I almost drank myself to death and no one seemed to care, other than my parents, of course. But yet, as a college student smoking pot, cops and police and the government is so interested and so concerned, and I realized that this is just insane. You know, this is having a crazy effect on our country. It's making alcohol far more acceptable and marijuana far less acceptable. And the consequences associated with marijuana laws are far more harmful than those associated with the substance itself. And it really got me into viewing this issue not just as a fight over whether marijuana should be legal, but a fight over whether we should have laws that are rational and sensible and just and evidence-based. This is really, for me now, this issue has become a litmus test for particularly elected officials I deal with. If they can't recognize that marijuana should be made legal, or they can't understand that it's ridiculous, that it's illegal, and so on, I don't know that I, you know, can support them or that I that we're a good fit, because I find that this is an egregiously harmful policy, and it's just a no-brainer when it comes to whether it should be changed.
Well, Mason Twert, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? And you're the co-author.
Thank you for having me.
Mason Twert. He's executive director of Safer Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation. Coming up, we talk with Peter Vickery. He's working on a series of historical thrillers about black lawyers and journalists fighting for civil rights during the early years of the 20th century. I first met Peter Vickery when he was running for election to the Massachusetts Governor's Council in 2004. He won the seat and served a term as a progressive voice on the council. Politics is one love of Vickery's, the law is another. He's an attorney, and writing is a third. Putting the last two interests together, he's taught legal writing at the University of Connecticut. But lately, he's turned his pen to another kind of writing, historical thrillers that bring together all his interests. He's completed one of a series about the struggle for civil rights in the early years of the 20th century. It's called Madison Hopper and the African American Blood Brotherhood.
It's a legal historical thriller, an espionage thriller, and it has to do with African American legal history. The book is about a young black British spy and his attempt to track down the killer of a young black journalist in Boston in the so-called Red Summer of 1919. And it had been germinating. The story had been germinating since about 1998. I was working as a research assistant when I was at law school, Boston University School of Law, working for a professor whose specialty was legal history. And what I was researching was African-American legal history, and discovered just some extraordinary stories about early black attorneys in the mid to late 19th century and the early 20th century. And what really captured my imagination was the efforts of Booker T. Washington, his kind of secret life, his non-accommodationist life.
And tell us who he was.
He was the, for a quite a long period, the unchallenged leader of black America from the 1890s through the early years of the 20th century. And he was popular in some quarters because he preached a doctrine of accommodationism, meaning let's not challenge Jim Crow, let's not agitate for civil rights, let's just focus on economic development and wait for civil rights later. Of course, he eventually found himself confronted by a younger generation of radicals like William Monroe Trotter and W.E.B. Du Bois, who were not content with that approach. But while he was saying that in public, while he was preaching this doctrine of accommodationism in public, he was secretly helping fund legal challenges to Jim Crow. And that's where my family history and the black legal history converged, because it turned out that one of my wife's ancestors was one of the attorneys who worked with Booker T. Washington to challenge segregation in the South. So all these things came together, and I really thought to myself, this is absolutely fascinating, not just academically, but what great, thrilling stories are in here. So that's when the book started to take shape.
And where does espionage come into this?
Where it really came into my studies was with the case of William Munro Trotter, who was a publisher of the Boston Guardian here in Massachusetts.
He's a real historical character.
Yes, he's real. And he was publishing his newspaper called the Boston Guardian during the early years of World War One, and he, like many other black newspaper publishers at the time, got a visit from military intelligence. Military intelligence would visit the leaders of the black community and newspaper publishers and editors in particular, and urge them to get on side to support the war effort. And the spy who visited him, the guy from military intelligence, was a fellow called Walter Loving. So that kind of piqued my curiosity, that there was an African-American military intelligence officer who was doing the rounds of the black newspapers, telling people to stop being so radical, don't agitate, don't speak out against the war, get on side.
This was during the Woodrow Wilson administration, and so we're talking about an extremely racist time in America.
Absolutely. This is the nadir of race relations, yes.
I think you could say that. A lot of lynchings happened at this time.
There were roughly 100 lynchings a year, and under Wilson, Jim Crow was institutionalized in the federal government. So things, in terms of racial equality, things were getting much worse under Woodrow Wilson, much worse during World War One. And it was that strange dichotomy that there were hundreds of thousands of African-American soldiers, officers and enlisted men, fighting in France, in Flanders, for democracy. As Woodrow Wilson put it, we're fighting to make the world safe for democracy. And they were fighting to make democracy safe in the United States of America, or to make the United States of America a place where democracy could grow. And the fact that it wasn't safe for democracy at the time was this dreadful irony that made the year 1919, when things really came to a head, just the perfect setting for a book about this confluence of black radicalism and espionage. And Walter Loving, a real character, features a little in the book, but the protagonist isn't Walter Loving, and it's not William Munro Trotter. The protagonist is a black British spy who's not real. He's somebody from my imagination, but based on a couple of real characters, including a black British officer from World War One called Walter Tull, who was real, and he was a soccer star before the war, and apparently died during World War One. And it was, in a sense, the absence of a body that got me thinking, well, what would this real man have done had he not died, if he died, during World War One? What if he'd gone on to be a spy? And so the book kind of came from what would Walter Tull have done had he survived. And Walter Tull is the real person behind Harry Walcott, who's the hero of the story.
Now, why would a black British spy get involved, be in the employ of the U.S. military?
He's not working for a U.S. military. And without giving too much of the plot away, I can say that Marcus Garvey's interest in Liberia...
And tell us who Marcus Garvey was.
Yes, Marcus Garvey was... that's a question that, 100 years ago, everybody would have known in the early years of the 20th century who Marcus Garvey was, but he was this towering black nationalist leader from Jamaica, but very popular in the United States, who in the years immediately after World War One had an enormous following. And there are wonderful photographs of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which he founded and headed up for a number of years by Van der Zee, this photographer from Harlem. So if you look at these photographs, you get a real sense of Marcus Garvey and his movement. And what his movement was about was the fight for full equality. And an aspect of it was the Back to Africa movement. So Marcus Garvey was demanding full equality for people of color in the United States and worldwide, and encouraging some people to move to a colony that he hoped to found in Africa. So the British government had an interest in Garvey. Various kinds of interest. One, they weren't happy about him agitating for complete racial equality within the British Empire, but they were very happy for him to agitate for full racial equality in the United States, because in the wake of World War One, Great Britain and the United States were becoming rivals again. Britain was in debt to the US, and the United States was keen to assume, I think it's fair to say, I think many historians would say, the United States was looking to assume the mantle of the superpower that Britain no longer was. So Britain had an interest in promoting Garvey in the United States and keeping him out of the British Empire, and Marcus Garvey was interested in founding a colony in Liberia, within Liberia, which had itself been a colony that the United States helped found in the previous century. So Garvey is somebody who kind of keeps this story moving forward.
We're talking with Peter Vickery. He's a lawyer and a former member of the Massachusetts Governor's Council and has now turned his hand to writing historical thrillers. How did you decide to write a murder mystery, a thriller, out of this story rather than just a historical novel?
That's a great question, and partly because I just enjoy reading thrillers. I like the work of writers like Alan First and David Downing. I like historical espionage. And I thought that this host of characters that I'd been reading about since I was at law school, these real characters from African-American history, they caught my imagination, but so does historical espionage. And in a sense, it sounds so cliched, but I just had to write this kind of book. It just had to get out. I'd played with other forms of writing about this subject before. You've published a few academic articles about it, and like I think most other young attorneys, I had a screenplay or a treatment in my office drawer on this subject, but eventually I just wanted to get the novel written, the first one. So that was done, and as luck would have it, I was enjoying teaching legal writing at University of Connecticut School of Law, and the dean had to cut $900,000 from the budget, and one of the things he cut was me. So I found that I had a summer to finally get this novel under my belt. So it was a very well-disguised blessing. But while I was coming to terms with the fact that I wasn't going to be teaching legal writing at UConn School of Law in the future, I decided just to get the novel written and had the summer to do that, or did. And as we mentioned earlier, I'm now working on the sequel. Harry survives. Harry Walcott, our hero, does survive the first book and goes on to fight again in book two.
I'd like to go back for a minute to this historical period you write about. You talked about 1919. You said it was a critical year. Just a year or two later, there were the Palmer raids. Put this in a little bit of perspective. Is there a connection between the African-American campaign for equality and other social movements going on at this time?
Yes, I think the quickest way to answer that question is to focus on the Russian Revolution, which had happened in 1917. And in 1919, there were still American troops involved fighting in the Russian Civil War on the sides of the whites, the anti-Bolshevik Russians. So there was an expeditionary force in northern Russia, in Siberia, British soldiers as well as American and French. And there was this real fear that Bolshevism would spread. And one of the people who a young federal investigator called J. Edgar Hoover was very interested in making sure that Bolshevism did not spread. And he saw the African-American struggle for equality as being kind of a carrier for this virus of Bolshevism. So he was somewhat paranoid about people like Garvey and people like Du Bois, people who were agitating for equality. He believed, or at least appeared to believe, that the struggle for racial equality was a way of advancing the interests of Bolshevism in the United States. So he saw black activism and socialism as pretty much synonymous.
So far, you've told us about some black attorneys who were fighting for civil rights. Tell us a little bit about where this was happening and how wide a movement it was. How is this integrated into the life of African Americans of that time?
Well, let's go back to, let's say, 1883, when the Supreme Court of the United States really eviscerated the civil rights law. There was the Federal Civil Rights Act, which in 1883 the Supreme Court effectively gutted by saying the 14th Amendment only permitted Congress to prohibit state acts of discrimination. So private actors were free to discriminate. So how to respond to that was the question that confronted leading African-American, well, civic leaders in the community. How to respond to that federal gutting of the civil rights law? And the way that black leaders decided to respond to that was with state-level litigation and state-level legislation. So here in Massachusetts, for example, there was litigation around discrimination in barbershops, in skating rinks, and other places of, in quotes, public accommodation. So black leaders met together. I think here it was called the Wendell Phillips Club. They named their organization after the famous white abolitionist Wendell Phillips. And they met regularly through the mid to late 1880s and decided how to formulate a response to what the Supreme Court had done. So that succeeded. Here in Massachusetts, we have a long kind of laundry list of places where discrimination is unlawful. That's one approach that leading black attorneys, teachers, janitors, union leaders took here in Massachusetts. They decided how to respond, and they made it happen. They took cases to court, and they petitioned the legislature, and there were at that time, you know, some small number, but definitely a few African-American legislators here in Massachusetts who pushed these bills for anti-discrimination forward. So from the 1880s, there was a pretty active civil rights movement here in Massachusetts and in other parts of New England, and they really were the nucleus of the movement that came into more fruition in the early years of the 20th century. So a couple of individuals really stand out. One was an African-American attorney named Butler Wilson, who was originally from Georgia and came north to go to law school in Boston and decided to stay in Massachusetts. And he is somebody who was very active in this Wendell Phillips Club, the organization that lobbied for civil rights in Massachusetts. And he went on to help co-found the NAACP in this part of the world. And he also represented people who the southern states were trying to take back into effectively peonage. So when people would flee southern states and come to Massachusetts in the early years of the 20th century, right up into the 1940s, Butler Wilson would represent them in extradition hearings to prevent them being extradited back to the South.
So when you say peonage, how did this work? Are you talking about sharecroppers and that they didn't have a right to go off the land?
Well, remember that there's this huge exception in the Constitution. The part that abolished slavery has a loophole, and it says, you know, slavery is still constitutional as punishment for a crime. So what would happen in the South would be that people would be, African-American men would be arrested, put in prison, and then used as slave labor. So the mines in the South and the steelworks in the South often had African-American workers who were effectively slaves. So some people would escape, and they'd come north, and people like Butler Wilson would represent them and try to prevent them being sent back to prison and, in effect, slavery in the South. Butler Wilson was also one of the people who helped lead the protests against the screening of Birth of a Nation, a motion picture that President Wilson thought was history written in lightning. You know, he's a big fan of Birth of a Nation.
D.W. Griffiths, it was a very racist depiction, pro-South in the Civil War movie.
And it implied that the Ku Klux Klan were heroes and that Reconstruction was a disaster. Mm-hmm. So this misrepresentation of history is what, you know, drew the ire of African-American leaders, people like Butler Wilson, who knew that the effects of this kind of racist propaganda would be, you know, increased violence against people of color. And as we were talking about earlier, this is a time when there were roughly 100 instances of, you know, the public mutilation, torture, and murder of African-Americans every year. It was a form of, you know, for want of a better phrase, state-sponsored terrorism designed to keep African-Americans subjugated.
State-sponsored?
State-sponsored. I mean, the government functionaries in the South and the lynch mobs very often were the same people, or at least worked hand in hand. So, you know, it's the terrorism that was lynching in many southern states was supported by the governments in those states, unfortunately. So people like Butler Wilson helped lead protests against Birth of a Nation and helped prevent people get sent back to the South and helped found organizations like the NAACP and the Niagara Movement. So Butler Wilson doesn't feature largely in my fictional work, Madison Hopper and the African Blood Brotherhood, but somebody like him makes an appearance. There are people like Butler Wilson in the book, but the book is not about the struggle for civil rights. That is the backdrop of 1919, the Red Summer of 1919.
Why is it called the Red Summer of 1919?
It's not to do with the Red Scare, but it has more to do with blood, that kind of red. There were 24 so-called race riots or pogroms during 1919. Chicago, for example, where there was a white riot against the African-American people who lived in the city of Chicago. So during 1919, there were race riots across the United States of increasing ferocity. So that's why historians call it the Red Summer. And not coincidentally, the Red Scare came on the heels of that. So when the Palmer Raids began and people started being deported and prosecuted for being social Democrats, socialists, or Bolsheviks, this was all happening at roughly the same time, which makes it a, you know, fascinating period to write about.
And we're talking with Peter Vickery about the first in a series of thrillers that take place during the Woodrow Wilson administration and center around the African-American struggle for civil rights. One thing that interests me, back in the beginning, you said that there was an attempt during World War I to get black activists on the side of the U.S. military in supporting the war in Europe. Why?
Well, some of them were already on side. Famously, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an editorial for The Crisis, which was the magazine of the NAACP, called Close Ranks. And his argument was that if African Americans supported the U.S. intervention in World War I, and actively supported it by joining the military, then things would get better at home. And that was the feeling of many, many other activists, Ida B. Wells included, that if African Americans supported the war effort, they would be, in a sense, in quotes, rewarded by full civil rights here in the United States. Didn't work out. And as the war went along, many leading African American newspaper publishers and editors spoke out about the fact that it really wasn't working, that the number of lynchings was going up, that racial violence was on the increase. There was a real uptick in these acts of terrorism against the black community. And so the black newspaper editors started to look as though they would begin speaking out publicly against the war. And that led military intelligence to visit them and explain to them that if they wanted to keep having their magazines and newspapers sent through the mails, then they had better get on side and better stick with the story, which was that the war is good.
Is it just coincidental that racial violence increased during the war, or do you think that one can draw some kind of connections between the two?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think you can connect some dots between the message from the government, which was that basically foreigners are bad, people who are different are bad, American nationalism is good. You can connect the dots between that aspect of the war effort and the uptick in violence against people of color in the United States.
That's Peter Vickery. He's a writer, a lawyer, and a former member of the Massachusetts Governor's Council. He's working on the next book in the series, of which the first we talked about today is Madison Hopper and the African American Blood Brotherhood. Well, we've got a little time left, and I'd like to take advantage of it by reading a couple of poems, as is my wont when we have a few minutes left on the show. A couple of years ago, I invited a young friend of mine onto Writer's Voice to read his poetry. Josh Krugman was then a junior in high school, and his work showed real promise. Now he's graduated and has continued to write poetry. At the age of 19, he's gotten some of his work published in the poetry journal Osiris. I'd like to read two short poems of his the journal published. The first one is without a title. Navigating an empty loft, we look out where evening presses into the land and the river climbs the plank bridge. I recognize the remains of your voice in the lights of the barge across the river's mouth. Then moths issue from the word and enter the sun. And the second poem, in November. In the night of frequent equinoxes, full of the sea, we were both heavy with ourselves. The magnolias were in bloom, and their voices rushed past us. Those are two poems by Josh Krugman, published in Osiris, edition 69. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.